I'm going to have to overlook the dean's reference to me before getting started. You know, that was a great introduction, and I didn't want to say anything about it, but, you know, hardest part of preaching chapel is putting this microphone on. Y'all ever wear one of these microphones? It took three of us to put this thing on. The dean looked at me, and he said, "You look like Madonna." And I'm thinking, yeah, where's Logan Carson when you need him? It is my privilege to be here today, and I'm so glad to be here. Before I get started, if you would allow me just a moment, I've got some friends I want to recognize here. The Lord has blessed me tremendously with the opportunity to serve the Greenwood Baptist Church as their interim pastor, and there's a group from Greenwood that's here today. I have Reverend Steve Van Osdell, one of the finest youth ministers in captivity. I have Jerry Livengood and his lovely wife, Carolyn. I have John Gore and his wife, Peggy. Would you guys stand up for just a second and wave to everybody? There you go. Marvelous, marvelous church. And if you happen to have your resume on you, Jerry is the chairman of the pulpit committee, and you can give that to him on the way out. We'll talk later about which ones you need to pitch. Okay. No problem. I also have Mrs. Janie Watkins here today. Especially privileged to have Edie Jeter, our archivist at the IMB. And you can stand up and wave at these folks if you would, please. Yeah, come on, come on. No? All right, don't then. I'm especially pleased today to have Miss Universe from 19, well, the date's not important, but my lovely wife, Johnny, and I'm very glad that she is here. Now, before we really dig into this, one more person that I want to bring to your attention is Laura White, because without her, it would have been very difficult to do this project. Laura was my research assistant on this project, and she is really found some very interesting information that we're going to share with you under the heading of Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. Issachar J. Cox Roberts and the Shaping of Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Efforts. When one thinks of Southern Baptist missionaries, there are several heroes and heroines who come to mind. There's Lottie Moon, whose 39-year career in China remains as our supreme example of one missionary's self-sacrifice and surrender to Christ. One might also think of Bill Wallace's heroism or Annie Armstrong's determined, pragmatic approach to financing missionary endeavors, not to mention her role in shaping WMU in its earliest days. Of the dozens of names one might mention, it is safe to say that no one thinks of Issachar J. Cox Roberts. Little wonder. There are no offerings named for him. He has no entry in the Encyclopedia of Southern Baptists, and William Eastup scarcely mentioned him in the most recent history of the International Mission Board, Whole Gospel, Whole World. Yet of the thousands of missionaries Southern Baptists have sent into service, I.J. Roberts may be the most important. His brief career raised nearly every major issue the Foreign Board would face in its first 100 years, and thereby forced the board to consider how it would interact with its missionaries, not to mention how they in turn would interact with the board, with each other, and their supporters back in America. I struggled to find the perfect designation for this guy. I thought about scum-sucking dog, but no, that would be a little bit harsh. Besides, it's someone else's epithet of choice. So I decided to describe Roberts as a sleazy weasel, for reasons that you are about to discover. Issachar J. Cox Roberts was born February 17, 1802, in Sumter County, Tennessee. He converted to Christianity on March 19, 1821, and was ordained to the gospel ministry 7 years later in 1828. On January 4, 1830, he married Miss Barsha Blanchard, who unfortunately died the following year. According to his own testimony, Robert surrendered his life for missionary work in China on his birthday in 1835 after 9 months of prayer and deliberation. "I took the word of God for my warrant," he recalled. My inward conviction of duty for my prompter, and by faith I resolved, not knowing how the thing should be accomplished, but trusted all to God who commended to bring it to pass. Undaunted by friends and family who encouraged him to stay in America, Roberts left for China in April 1836. There was scarcely anything about I.J. Roberts' tenure as a missionary that one might deem typical. For instance, before leaving for China, Roberts liquidated his assets and created the Roberts Fund and China Mission Society. Endowed with $30,000, Roberts planned to support himself, his native assistants, and his sundry ventures in China. You heard me correctly. Roberts sent himself to the field. He operated as an independent missionary in Macau for about 6 years, where he ministered to a congregation of lepers. He also preached in Hong Kong and later Canton. Meanwhile, John L. Burroughs, W.C. Buck, and others served as agents in Kentucky for Roberts' work. But the economy of the 1830s and 40s was unstable and prone to periods of boom and bust. One could make a fortune. One could lose a fortune. And unfortunately, Burroughs and Buck proved unable to maintain their self-endowed missionary, and by the early 1840s, Roberts had depleted nearly all of his missionary fund. Forced to seek new revenue, the Roberts Fund officially became the China Mission Society of Kentucky, auxiliary to the American Baptist Foreign Mission Board, Boston, in 1842. The arrangement did not last long, however, and soon after Southern Baptists established their own foreign mission board, Roberts quickly offered his services. He never stated explicitly why he wanted to leave the Boston board, but he may have clashed with the Massachusetts brethren over how he spent his money in China. In an oblique reference to his brief stint with the Northern Board, Roberts complained that they had a nasty little habit of passing resolutions and then expecting the missionaries to carry them into effect, without giving reason for why they had taken the measure. It was, Roberts said, something I objected strongly to because it's not a Republican principle and can only be enforced by martial law. My translation, I'll take your money, but not your advice. Eager to expand their China work, the Foreign Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention accepted Roberts as their third foreign missionary in 1846. Their enthusiastic newbie wrote home, quote, "See what God has wrought in his providence for us, even exceeding our most sanguine expectations to openings for the reception of the gospel. Who knows whether the Southern Baptist Board has not been constituted for a time such as this?" Accepting Roberts as their missionary, however, there was a catch. The China Mission Society of Kentucky agreed to surrender their funds to the Foreign Mission Board along with other funds received during the year if the board would earmark such funds for Roberts and his associates. In a word, Roberts wanted to receive funding and recognition from the Richmond Board while retaining a measure of independence through his former society. Roberts got off on the wrong foot with the Foreign Mission Board. On February the 21st, 1846, he complained through the pages of The Baptist, a denominational newspaper in Tennessee that would later become the Tennessee Baptist, that he had insufficient support to evangelize China. He noted, "I received no assistance from any board or society at the East, and hence am under the necessity of appealing to my own brethren and sisters of Tennessee and the West for pecuniary aid." Things got worse in July when he complained that he was destitute. And that was a shame because, according to Roberts, he might be the only Baptist in China who could preach to the Chinese directly in their own language. The Baptist's editor smelled a rat and responded, "Our brother is not, we presume, to be understood as saying that we have no other missionaries than himself who can preach in Chinese." And as for being destitute, the editor remarked that Roberts should have received support from the Boston board until that association had been dissolved. And further, Roberts, by his own request, regularly received and is supported by the Board of Foreign Missions of the Southern Baptist Convention. Finally, the editor did not understand why Roberts maintained a separate connection with the China Mission Society of Kentucky if he was, in fact, a Southern Baptist missionary. Why then, the editor asked, should he so particularly desire his support to come to him through the China Mission Society of Kentucky? We need more light on these subjects. Robert's status as a quasi-independent missionary immediately caused problems with his fellow missionaries. He had retained property for his congregation at a place called Ut Tang. His facilities were not in the best of condition, however, and he wanted money from Richmond that would maintain property that the board did not own, a real no-no by board standards. Additionally, Southern Baptist missionaries grew weary with Robert's demeanor and overestimation of his own self-worth. His cavalier approach to missions, coupled with his reluctance to fully cooperate with the Foreign Mission Board, led certain missionaries to complain. Soon letters began pouring into the board's defenseless mailbox, and it appeared that everyone complained about the new guy. But a somewhat conciliatory Roberts forgave his critics and confided to the board that most of his fellow missionaries were either sick or just too inexperienced to understand him. What a weasel. Of course, Roberts could complain too, and he quickly proved that he was no slouch when it came to belly aching. Most of his complaints focused on money. In a letter dated August 18, 1847, Roberts said, "I beg leave here to make a statement." Count the personal pronouns. "I make a statement of my money matters to the board in order, if possible, to get some relief." He further claimed, "And as I know the China Mission Society of Kentucky had passed resolutions in my favor to turn their funds over to my use, I therefore expected my own personal expenses and salary, and at least part of my contingent expenses would be refunded so as to be applied to their legitimate use, i.e., towards building my chapel and mission house." He was aggravated. And after lambasting the board about his finances, he shocked the Richmond Brethren by asking them to send a single female missionary to China. Mrs. Samuel Clopton and Mrs. George Piercy, wives of Southern Baptist missionaries in China, had helped secure a female congregation that needed special attention. In fact, Roberts noted that missionaries of every preaching point were located without females were only half prepared for the usefulness they might achieve with that useful and pleasant addition. In other words, female missionaries had opportunities to work with Chinese women that male missionaries did not have. However, Roberts had an ulterior motive in asking for a female missionary. He wanted a mate. He asked the board to, quote, "send me a suitable female of sound health and mind, of the missionary spirit, and a Baptist in profession, suitably qualified with to cooperate with me in Canton, first as an assistant with me in this great work, and second as a wife." He promised, God willing, to take her for better or worse, and with her consent to unite with her in marriage after arriving in China. Now, should the Foreign Mission Board choose not to honor his request, Roberts asked them to at least pass a resolution allowing him to return to America at his own convenience, of course, and find his own wife. Now, he assured the board he was not picky, and he claimed he would gladly sacrifice his taste to the board's judgment. Now, of course, back in the day, he said his fancy generally selected from those who were neither too large nor too small, about the middling size in person, of a face what is generally considered a good countenance, with high forehead, full temples, black hair, and black eyes. Hey, in the days before eHarmony.com, FMB, FMB.org/Love Shack sounded mighty good. What was a lonely missionary to do? You're making this up. He couldn't be serious, could he? Well, in fact, he was. Roberts claimed that he got this idea from fellow single missionary Francis Johnson, son of William B. Johnson, first president of the Southern Baptist Convention. According to Roberts, his colleague had already arranged for the board to send him a wife whenever he wanted one. Done deal. In any event, Roberts was so convinced that the board would comply with his request that he suggested they form a committee to find the future Mrs. Roberts. I was flexible on this point, to be sure, but he believed the committee should at least include J.B. Jeter, who coincidentally was president of the Foreign Mission Board, J.B. Taylor, who was corresponding secretary of the Foreign Mission Board, and you know, whosoever should be the pastor of the church where the as-of-yet unnamed woman had her church membership. Convinced that the board would see the logic in his request, Roberts began sending notes to the unnamed female missionary that he hoped would become Mrs. Roberts. Guys, parenthetically, let me say that's always risky. Don't do that. His first two notes were rather pedestrian. He looked forward to meeting her, promised to look out for her, yada, 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 the whole thing. He got down to business on the third note, however, and he made no secret of his desire for a helper in ministry and a companion in life. Now, to allay her fears, Roberts assured her that Chinese couples got married all the time without courtship and thus took each other, for better or worse, without a single interview beforehand. All this for a woman he did not know by name and had never met. Meanwhile, Roberts' dispute with the board over money continued throughout 1848 and well into 1849. The Foreign Board's minutes, dated March 21, 1848, indicated that he had requested $2,000 to finish a chapel and a house that he had been working on for several years. The board declined his request because they would neither own or control the facility once it was completed. Instead, they resolved that Roberts should make his case for more money to the local mission and work through established procedures, particularly Rule Number 8, which stipulated, among other things, that the members of each mission were to work harmoniously with one another. By the way, there were only 10 rules that missionaries had to comply with. 10. That was it. By the end of 1848, Roberts decided that he needed to come back to America for a visit. He had been in China since 1836, and he needed a rest. Besides, he had never even met the brethren in Richmond, and Roberts had business with the board. The exact details are not available, but Roberts was present when the board met in August 1849. The minutes indicate that he met with the board, and after several hours of discussion, the board reluctantly agreed to provide him with $250 a year for rent. He'd worn them down. He also submitted a plan of operations for the entire China mission for 1850 that the board promised to give a due consideration. And apparently pleased with these efforts, Roberts headed on for Kentucky to visit family and friends there. In the meantime, two important events began to take shape. First, Miss Harriet Baker requested that the Foreign Board send her to China as a missionary. The board carefully considered her request and finally agreed on March 5, 1849. Apparently, some of Roberts' reasoning had influenced the board's thinking. They were not sending him a wife, but they saw a measure of logic in American women working with Chinese women and children. Hence, Harriet A. Baker became the first single female the Foreign Board appointed for international service. Shortly after Baker sought her appointment, another single female, Miss Virginia Young, petitioned the board for an appointment to China. Unfortunately, the board declined to appoint her. And in a letter dated December 4, 1849, the board thanked her for her zeal and interest in reaching China for Christ. Even so, sending Baker to China was risky, and they were still not entirely certain that they had made the correct decision in appointing her. They made no secret of the fact that Baker was a test case to determine whether or not they would send single females to the field in the future. At any rate, the board encouraged Young to use her pen and personal influence to spread the missionary cause wherever she went. They also added, "It may be that God, in His adorable providence, will at some future time indicate that you should go forth to the work. You may then cheerfully and confidently wait upon Him, and He will guide you into the path of your duty." Ah, providence. Well, the ink had barely dried on the board's letter of December 4th when Virginia Young proudly announced her upcoming nuptials with Issachar J. Cox Roberts. The details of how the happy couple met are long lost, but Roberts had numerous friends in Kentucky who knew that he was single and looking and that she was single and available. It looked like a match made in heaven. It wasn't, but it looked that way. And so, in the summer of 1850, the newlyweds sailed off for China. Now, it would be nice if I could tell you that they lived happily ever after, but they didn't. In fact, Robert's prior difficulties with the board and his fellow missionaries scarcely amounted to a decent dress rehearsal for the firestorm to come. Between the fall, 1850, and winter of 1851, life changed dramatically for everyone associated with the work in China. The difficulties the mission experienced during this time would forever shape all Southern Baptist missionary efforts. Indeed, this period will demonstrate why Roberts could very well be our most important missionary, sleazy weasel that he was. It's difficult to say if Roberts knew the board had sent a single female to China, but imagine his shock to arrive on the field with new wife in tow and a single American woman on the loose in Canton. On a personal level, the best he could hope for was that the board had not shared his emotive sonnets with the single female missionary who had not united with him in holy wedlock. On a professional level, Robert suddenly had no regard for the co-laborer for whom he had literally begged. The opportunities he had touted for a single female missionary vanished, and Baker soon learned just how miserable Roberts could make her life. He was obviously displeased with her presence, and Baker complained to the board that Roberts only allowed her $6 a month for a language teacher when good ones commanded at least $8 a month. There could be no mistake. Roberts wanted nothing to do with Harriet A. Baker. The situation worsened as news of what must surely be the most bizarre incident in the history of Southern Baptist missions filtered back to Richmond. Apparently, Harriet Baker had joined the Roberts family once they returned to China, but housing was scarce and expensive. Therefore, the trio moved in with a Reverend J.G. Bridgman, who happened to be a congregational missionary in China. Later reports suggest that Bridgman had been showing signs of mental instability for some time, bless his heart. And on December the 1st, 1850, he slit his throat with a razor and later died on December the 6th. Oh, it gets better. Virginia Roberts and Harriet Baker were alone in the house with Bridgman, and I.J. Roberts was some distance away on the preaching tour when this event took place. Fearing for their lives, the horrified women locked themselves in their rooms and began writing desperate notes for help that they hoped the house servants could deliver to someone, anyone, who would render them aid. Eventually, another missionary, Reverend J.B. French, found his way to the Bridgman residence and found Miss Baker sitting on the stairs while Virginia Roberts remained locked in a room. It wasn't long before one of the house servants returned with words from Roberts. He addressed his comments to his wife, but an excited Harriet Baker tore open the envelope and read a note that said, quote, "Let the dead bury their dead. I must preach the gospel. Mr. B. has enough of his own board to attend him." It hardly mattered that Roberts had scribbled his incomprehensible reply on the very note that had pleaded for his help. News of Bridgman's suicide and Robert's callous note quickly spread to the other missionaries. Once they were over their shock, they demanded answers from Roberts for his outrageous behavior. But instead of explaining himself, Roberts blamed Harriet Baker for spreading malicious rumors about him. He reasoned that if Baker had minded her own business and not read mail intended for somebody else, most of the subsequent unpleasantries could have been avoided. Baker apparently apologized repeatedly, but Roberts would hear none of it, and the other missionaries on the scene took note. They demanded that Roberts apologize for his actions, and he eventually did, but not before Harriet Baker had left the Canton mission and sailed north to Shanghai. The foreign board had finally had enough. In the summer 1851, they decided to sever their association with I.J. Roberts. Upon learning that he had been canned, a somewhat contrite Roberts wrote, "I received the painful intelligence of your resolution by which our connection has been temporarily dissolved." He was confident that the board would restore him once they knew the whole story, and that he would be allowed to serve out the remnant of his life enjoying the board's prayers, sympathies, and support. Ain't happening. The board, however, did not intend to reinstate Roberts, regardless of how eloquently he pleaded his case. Now, another missionary might have seen his dismissal from the board as a sure sign that he needed to repent from certain sins and seek forgiveness. But not our man Roberts. No, instead he launched a blistering attack against the Foreign Mission Board. In October 1852, he made the front page of the Western Recorder, the denomination's flagship paper in Kentucky. He complained that the board had mistreated him, and their failure to support him had injured his poor wife's health. Actually, she had been sick since they got to China. He also said that they were destitute. And Roberts promised a full disclosure of the recent unpleasantries between him and the board, but at the end of his first broadside, he did the unthinkable. He appended a brief note that said, "Will the Tennessee Baptist and the Southwestern Baptist please copy?" Now, it was common practice for 19th century newspapers to copy material from other papers. But the Tennessee Baptist and the Southwestern Baptist, which is the denominational paper of Alabama, along with the Western Recorder, were among the most widely read Baptist papers in the South. And to make matters worse, J.R. Graves had assumed editorial duties of the Tennessee paper in 1848, and his disdain for overly bureaucratic denominationalism, not to mention his landmarkism, was earning notoriety throughout the South. Before long, both papers had entered the fray, and the battle was on. The foreign board hoped that they could part company with Roberts quietly. After all, he had served in China for a number of years at his own expense, and the board had no desire to air their own dirty laundry, especially if it would embarrass everyone connected with Southern Baptist work in China. Roberts, however, had no such scruples. He bemoaned his fate in page after torturous page of the denominational papers. He also published correspondence between him and the board, as well as testimonials from others who swore that Roberts' character was above reproach. Well, it became obvious that Roberts wanted to turn Southern Baptists against their own foreign board. Many believed that he had been wronged. And one individual wrote the Western Recorder and exclaimed, "If I had heretofore felt no love for him for his own or the work's sake, I now at least would love him for the Christian character in his letters." The writer further stated that many Tennesseans believed the board had erred in dismissing Roberts. Indeed, the writer said, "Quite a number of us set forth our objections and most respectfully petitioned the board to reconsider the grounds of objection and, if possible, restore Brother Roberts." Well, board members knew they had a serious problem. Had they dismissed Roberts too hastily? Had they judged him too harshly? How would they respond to mounting criticism? Unknown to the public, the board had received so much information on Roberts that they were conducting what amounted to an ongoing investigation into his conduct and ministry in China. Safe to say that they were unprepared for what they would learn about their work in China in general, and Issachar J. Cox Roberts in particular. At first, the missionaries had rallied around Harriet Baker. Her most outspoken advocate, Matthew Yates, was a veteran missionary with a sterling character and reputation. Graduate of Wake Forest College, too, I might add. And in January of 1851, Yates informed the board that Roberts did not want Baker living in the same house with him and his wife. 1 month later, he wrote that Baker had moved to Shanghai because Roberts had, quote-unquote, driven her out of Canton. Yates characterized Roberts' conduct as outrageous, unmanly, and unchristian. He further noted that few in China had a kind word for him. Many Chinese nationals, men Roberts had known for 15 years, now refused to work with him. "I speak advisedly," said Yates, "when I say our board is greatly depreciated in China by its connection with Mr. R., and this feature is manifested still more clearly since his return, as but few expected that he would be sent back." While Yates may have defended Baker's character during the Roberts fiasco, he minced no words regarding her role in China. Yates saw no room for single female school teachers in China. He chided the board for sending Baker to China without communicating their intention to the missionaries on the field. But of course, that might have been because they didn't have a plan in sending her to the field. Should she establish a day school or a boarding school? Should she work exclusively with children or with children and adult women? Baker informed Yates that before leaving America, she had been instructed to, quote, "think and act independently," end quote. Obviously annoyed, Yates grumped to the board, "I hardly think you intended by your instructions to convey the idea that your missionaries were to be independent of each other." And he further argued that single females could not do missionary work without gross insult. And if they even had a place in the work, it was only in boarding schools where they would remain indoors. And even then, he saw little reason to educate Chinese girls when they would only become the wives of heathen or of young men educated in pedo-Baptist missions. So there. Other missionaries, including J. Lewis Shuck, the Foreign Board's first appointed missionary, expressed similar misgivings about schools and female education. In 1854, Harriet Baker, weary of her struggles, resigned her appointment and returned to America. Well, as the board pondered its mission philosophy and what to do about single female missionaries, I.J. Roberts made news once again. Having severed his connection from the Boston board, and having been severed from the Richmond board, Roberts offered a new scheme for Chinese mission work. On December 7, 1854, the Southwestern Baptist carried a lengthy article regarding Roberts' detailed scenario for winning China to Christ. The editor noted that Roberts' text was much too long to reproduce in toto, and while he neither approved nor disapproved of the plan, he claimed that he had reproduced sufficient text for interested readers to determine the plan's feasibility for themselves. His plan was fairly simple. He wanted to create a committee of cooperation that consisted of only male missionaries. Go figure. This proposed committee would be open to anyone who was willing to work cooperatively with the other members of the committee and Taiping Wang, a Chinese Baptist preacher and one of Roberts' most capable native assistants. Specifically, each committee member would be a Baptist, of course, and each would need a recommendation from their home church or sponsoring society. Each member would have equal standing in the committee, and the committee would draft its own constitution subject to annual review and amendment. Finally, the committee would meet annually in Nanking, China. Roberts believed that his plan offered missionaries a measure of individual freedom. He had served as an independent missionary and with both the Boston and Richmond boards. As he saw it, mission boards restricted missionary freedom, especially in areas like buying and selling real estate and where to establish new works. A local committee could make such decisions faster and more wisely than a board several thousand miles away. Hence, he believed the work in China would grow through sheer efficiency, if nothing else. As functional as this plan may appear, it's obvious that Roberts was still smarting from his dismissal as a Southern Baptist missionary. He claimed that his committee would remove the stigma of inequality between boards and missionaries, a stigma that amounted to an employer-employee relationship.
"Except we do as the board wish," he complained, "we will forfeit our bread at their option. While the members of the board are at liberty to speak, act, and vote as they please."
End quote. Oh yeah, speaking of voting, Roberts felt duty-bound to offer the rather pungent insight that boards could dismiss missionaries, but missionaries could not dismiss their boards. And furthermore, just in case you thought he was done complaining, Roberts believed his committee would promote harmony and peace among the missionaries by eliminating tattletale reports that left boards only partially informed about what was really going on the field. Roberts' grand plan may have touched a nerve with the board back in Richmond, because when the Southern Baptist Convention met in 1855, the Foreign Board finally issued the report of its findings into their investigation of I.J. Roberts' conduct. The board reported that, in their opinion, they had treated Roberts fairly throughout his brief tenure as their missionary, somewhat less than 5 years, and they expressed their displeasure that he had undermined the board by attacking them in the denominational newspapers. They also assured the convention that Roberts had been given opportunities to explain his actions, but that such explanations were always something less than satisfactory. Now, here's why I'm a historian. The board's report to the convention is 2 pages long, but the full report is 20 typewritten, single-spaced pages. And among other things, the board noted that after mature deliberation, we believe that the interests of the board and of the cause of missions have seriously suffered and will continue to suffer by Roberts remaining as our missionary. They noted that Roberts had consistently disregarded their wishes and disrespected other missionaries. And the final report quoted extensively from veteran missionary B.H. Wilden, who questioned nearly every facet of Roberts' character. He accused Roberts of encouraging deceitful behavior among his native assistants and lying about his work in his reports to the board. "I feel pained," Wilden said, "when I think of the erroneous impression which have been made on the minds of those who read Mr. Roberts' statements. Things in Canton are not as I expected to find them, and from what I know of Roberts' disregard for the truth, he has the tendency to excite in my mind suspicion whenever I read his statements." The board further noted, for the record, that Roberts' difficulties with Harriet Baker were not the only reason for his dismissal. Rather, Baker's mistreatment was merely the last episode in a drama that had played far longer than it should. If anything, the board admitted that they should have dismissed Roberts when he was on furlough, as Matthew Yates thought they might. Roberts' support began, or he began to lose support once word began to leak regarding the board's complete findings. Turned out that Southern Baptists did not appreciate his mishandling of the truth, and their enthusiasm for him waned when they learned that he really had been undermining the board, its work, and other missionaries. Roberts must have been especially stunned to read the September 29, 1855 edition of the Tennessee Baptist and learn that both J.M. Pendleton and J.R. Graves were repudiating their association with him. "Suppose," said Graves, "that the board should recall other missionaries as unworthy or unfit for the work. Would we who love missions be warranted on favoring a new mission for each and at the same time support the board in Richmond?" We think not. Graves pledged to help Roberts if he became destitute, but only because he would be a suffering brother in Christ. Now, at this point, we may be tempted to think, surely now everyone lived happily ever after. But alas, no, didn't work that way. Roberts' wife, Virginia, resigned her appointment in 1852 for health reasons. She was sick of him. And she moved back to America and finally settled in St. Louis, Missouri. Time forbids any serious discussion of Roberts' role in the Taiping Rebellion. He swore he didn't start it, and he might have a point, but one of his converts did. Anyway, he remained in China until he finally returned to America in 1866. He lived with a niece in Upper Alton, Illinois, not St. Louis, Missouri, with Mrs. Roberts. And on December 28, 1871, I.J. Roberts gave up the ghost and died of leprosy. Something poetic about that, I suppose. He left his estate, including real estate in China, to a missionary by the name of Roswell Hobart Graves. The board was less than amused. They told Graves they would not prohibit him from receiving Roberts' estate, but reminded him that he was a loyal missionary to the SBC, and it would be very difficult to pass that property along to succeeding generations. As for the widow Roberts, I'm glad you asked. The last mention of Virginia Young Roberts indicates that she asked the board for a portion of Roberts' estate, seeing that he had left her with absolutely nothing. Of all people, the board understood her plight, but they had absolutely no authority to grant her request. Now, the saga of I.J. Roberts is a fine yarn, if you like yarn, but his story is far more than mission field melodrama, Southern Baptist style. Roberts' brief stint as a Southern Baptist missionary raised a number of questions regarding how missionaries pursued their calling, how they related to one another, as well as to others at home, and ultimately, how they related to the board. Careful examination of these issues reveals why Roberts, weasel that he was, may yet be the most important missionary in the board's illustrious history. First, Roberts' shenanigans forced the Foreign Mission Board to create its own distinct identity at a very early stage in its history. The Foreign Board had been established in 1845, but beyond that, what could it do? What would it do? How would the board deal with an unruly missionary? Would the board terminate a problem missionary? How staunchly would the board defend its turf? How rigidly would they enforce their rules? Each of these questions hinged on one fundamental issue, namely the board's authority. In 1845, no one could say precisely what the board would do if a missionary dishonored himself, the mission, or the Lord. But by 1855, every Southern Baptist knew where the board stood. Thus, I.J. Roberts set precedences for disciplinary procedures and proved once and for all that the board would indeed terminate a missionary's appointment under extreme circumstances. Further, the board's dealings with I.J. Roberts settled an issue that every mission-minded denomination in the 19th century faced, namely, who directed the work? Was it the missionary on the field, or was it the board back home? The foreign board displayed considerable trust in their missionaries, Roberts notwithstanding, and their missionaries enjoyed great latitude in directing their work. However, the board claimed final say over how the missionaries did their work, and that came in large part because of Issachar J. Cox Roberts. In addition to forcing the board to define its role in administrating missionary activity, Roberts played an important role in shaping Southern Baptist journalism, believe it or not. Between 1820 and 1920, Americans enjoyed a veritable golden age of religious journalism. Of course, Southern Baptists did not have their own permanent publishing house until 1891, and that was due partially to the American Baptist Publication Society, as well as numerous outstanding state papers like the Tennessee Baptist, the Southwestern Baptist, the Western Recorder, and so on. These papers printed everything from doctrinal treatises and serial novels to denominational doings, aka gossip, and want ads. At a time when many preachers had few educational opportunities, the paper kept them informed and provided a measure of informal Bible training. Some zealous, enterprising student looking for a dissertation topic may someday want to tackle a project, something like this, and tell us more about these papers. But in Robert's case, the newspapers played at least two different roles. On the one hand, they gave him a platform to air his grievances. The foreign board never challenged Robert's right to use the religious media. Other missionaries used the religious media, and in short, they could not challenge that because it was one way to keep in touch with the folks back home. The board, however, did not appreciate him misusing the media, and neither did rank-and-file Southern Baptist once they learned the truth. So on the other hand, Robert's strategy backfired, and the media that initially supported him turned to the board. In other words, the Roberts fiasco generated support for the board, not Roberts, and thereby helped solidify the board's hold on the Southern Baptist imagination as their missionary sending agencies. And it also helped to define the media's role in shaping the emerging denomination. As for women, ladies, I.J. Roberts was instrumental in getting single female missionaries on the field. The board took him seriously when he said that single women had a significant role to play in China. Unfortunately, his mistreatment of Harriet Baker set women back by about 20 years, and the board would not consider sending another single female to China until Edmonia Moon in 1872, and even then, she immediately went to work with T.P. and Martha Crawford in northern China. Edmonia's more celebrated sister Lottie began changing the role of Southern Baptist women on the field, but that is another story for a different day. Suffice it to say that single women became a regular feature of Southern Baptist missionary efforts. By 1920, Southern Baptists had appointed some 375 missionaries to China, 113 of whom were single females. And when one considers the married and single females together, the board's female appointments to China outnumbered the male appointments to China by a ratio of roughly 2-1. If Roberts' request for a single female offered new opportunities for women, it also raised the issue of proper spheres of service. Yeats and numerous other missionaries made it clear to their way of thinking that women should have very limited roles if they were given a role at all. Harriet Baker and the Moon Sisters could teach, and that raised an entirely different set of questions about mission methodology. Was it right to create schools, day or boarding, to spread the gospel? Over time, Southern Baptists grew more comfortable with women on the field and evangelizing Chinese children in schools. They also warmed to the idea that women really could reach women. They absorbed Lottie Moon's stirring accounts of her own country work, a type of confrontational evangelism where she shared Christ in Chinese villages woman to woman and sometimes woman to man. Moon carefully reminded her readers that if there were a sufficient number of men on the field, no one would ever have to worry that women occasionally stepped over the gender line to share the gospel. Anyway, Harriet Baker opened the door for missionary teachers and later nurses, even doctors, to answer God's call on their life to serve Him in China. And I hate to say this, but I.J. Roberts had opened the door for Harriet Baker. Finally, I.J. Roberts' tenure as a Southern Baptist missionary raised important questions regarding the way missionaries ordered their lives on the field. How did they adjust to their new homes and callings? How did they conduct their daily business? How did they interact with missionaries of other denominations? I mean, after all, J.G. Bridgman was a Congregationalist. Was it common practice for Baptists to live with non-Baptists? I'll answer that one for you. The answer is no, it was not. But then again, missionaries were foreigners living in a strange land, and they sometimes had to adapt to their circumstances as a simple matter of survival. Lottie Moon's correspondence indicates that she interacted with non-Baptists on personal and professional levels. On one occasion, she informed the board that missionaries lived according to what she called certain unwritten rules, one of which was that missionaries would not tell their boards about another missionary's personal problems, or, in common contemporary parlance, we don't rat each other out. Unfortunately, this is the only unwritten law that she bothered to share, and I guess that's why they were unwritten. So, in what areas did they interact? These questions cry out for more inquiry and analysis. Thus, we end our saga of Issachar J. Cox Roberts, perhaps appropriately, with more questions than answers. Controversy marked every facet of his career, yet he always had an answer for his critics, or so he thought. He alienated nearly everyone he ever met, except for his staunchest supporters, who only had to deal with him face-to-face once every 10 or 12 years. His callous insensitivity cost him his marriage and his appointment as a Southern Baptist missionary in China. He really was a weasel. Even so,